General Motors on safari. Here is adventure. Excitement. And danger. Bringing you the African bushveld of today and yesterday in dramatized fact, fiction, and true life documentary. General Motors on safari.
For nearly 15,000 years, the Bushmen inhabited nearly all of Southern Africa, roaming free, nomad hunters. But with the sudden spread of Bantu-speaking tribes and the northward push of European settlers, the Bushmen were forced into the semi-desert wastes of Bechuanaland and Southwest Africa. In these remote parts, they have managed to survive, relatively undisturbed. In the northwestern corner of Bechuanaland dwell the Massawa, the Black River Bushmen of the Okavango swamps. Taller than the Kalahari Bushmen and darker-skinned, they have lived for centuries in this area, roaming the savannah plains in search of game. Their tracking abilities and general bushcraft is unbelievable. As hunters, they have few rivals. Few people have ever accompanied them on their hunts. To keep up with them for anything up to 24 hours on foot, in the burning heat of the day, in thick Kalahari-type sand, would test the stamina of the fittest man. However, Robert Kay and Gordon Pethick made the attempt to record, surely for the first time, the full story of a bushman hunt. I have called it In the Tracks of the Massawa. In the winter season, when the game is concentrated at waterholes or along the banks of the rivers, the Black River Bushmen set up temporary hunting camps in the immediate vicinity. For 8 months of the year, they will live solely as hunters before returning to their summer camp to plant their crops, their pumpkins and watermelons. On this early winter's morning, the Massawa are preparing for a buffalo hunt. The village is alive with activity. Here, a man is forging his arrowheads. Another is waxing his bow stave. A third is lacing his bowstring. A fourth is sharpening his spearhead. They have been preparing for 3 days, and their work is nearly complete.
I'm now standing next to one of the bushmen who's just completed his preparations. He's actually varnishing his bow stave with what appears to be honey wax, and a very wicked-looking instrument this bow is, too. It stands about 4 foot high. That apparently is the average height of a bushman bow, the Massawa bushman bow. And it's about an inch thick at the center and tapers to points at either end. It's been fashioned out of the green sapling of a mapani bush, I understand, and picking it up a few moments ago, it seemed to weigh something in the region of 10 or 12 ounces. Notches have been let into either end of the bow to house the bowstring. The bowstring is apparently made from the sinews of a dacre, or so I understood from my interpreter, Jackson. Three sinews that have been laced together to form quite a formidable-looking bowstring. And the interesting thing about it is that the correct tension is apparently determined by musical pitch. And it's quite fun to see the bushmen sitting by their forges with their bowstring held close to the ear, letting it go with a twang. And then they listen to the sound. If it's too high or too low, they merely adjust the tension of the bow until it settles down to the required musical tone. The arrows are even more interesting. They're made in three parts. There's the arrow head, the link shaft, and the main shaft. I'm actually holding one in my hand at the moment. It's about 20 inches long. That's the overall length, 20 inches. And the arrowhead itself is about 4 inches, beaten out of a 4-inch nail, I understand. Very narrow, with barbs at either corner, and the head of the nail, of course, has been chopped off. The second section is the link shaft, which is a 4-inch length of tubular wood. I say tubular because it's completely hollow inside, and the forward end of the link shaft fits over the foot of the arrowhead and is bound with gut or sinew. The same thing applies to the main shaft. The forward end of the main shaft fits into the rear end of the link shaft and is again bound with gut or sinew. And the reason is this, that when the arrow enters a moving target, The particular animal might get such a fright that it'll try to brush the arrow out by rubbing itself against a tree or even by biting at the arrow. Well, what actually happens in a case like that is that the main shaft comes detached from the link shaft, leaving the arrowhead firmly embedded in the skin of the stricken beast, and the bushman himself can come up and pick up his main shaft at a later stage and save himself time and bother on the next hunt. Each bushman will carry his bow, his arrows, five of them, slung in a quiver. The quiver's about 2 foot long, very narrow, made out of various skins. The chap in front of me, the bushman who's busy with his bow, has actually got a very marvellous looking quiver, which he's very proud of. Apparently he's had it for 3 or 4 seasons, made out of sable skin. He'll also carry a knapsack, usually made of impala skin, to house spare arrowheads, spare link shafts, and maybe even spare poison. And, of course, his rations for the day, which will include biltong and marula nuts. And the leading bushman, whose name I wouldn't even dare to pronounce, also carries a spear, a very hefty-looking thing with a big iron broad head. The overall length is about 5 foot, I should imagine, and the arrow, or the spearhead itself, is about 5 inches across. So all the bushmen on this hunt, the 4 of them that are coming with us, will be fairly laden down with their tools, but I understand that on a buffalo hunt, each one is vitally essential. And, of course, there's the poison. Jackson, can you ask the headman how the poison is made?
Yes, I'm sure that I know the poison, the medicine. I know 3 kinds of medicines. One is a root of muselesele, and the second medicine is a worm from a larva. Then the second one is a root from marula, digging the root of marula.
So there's the marula root, the muselesele root, yes, and the worm.
The worm. These are the 3 kinds of the poison which I know.
And they're all mixed together, are they?
They're all mixed together.
The hunters gather at the headman's hut to drink a last cup of honey water, a traditional toast to the hunt to come.
Now, what is this? This is a curious-looking mixture. What have you got in there?
This, I've got the honey.
This is the honey. And what are all these floating bodies inside there?
These bodies are the bees.
And you mean to tell me, Jackson, that they'll drink the whole thing, or will they leave the bees behind?
No, we just drink the water and leave the bees inside.
Is it just water and bees mixed?
Yes, just water and bees mixed. If you like, you can taste it. It's very nice.
I'll just take a little on my finger. Wow, it's very sweet. Yes, it's very nice.
Very nice.
The 4 men, together with Kay and Pethick, set out at 7 in the morning. Pethick with his tape recorder, a 20-pound dead weight that was to prove a heavy burden as the day wore on. They found the spoor an hour later.
What do they say, Robert? They say that they're looking for buffalo, and we've come across this spoor. But the way they're going, unfortunately, is downwind. And we'll have to get right out into that open plain with the grasses beyond it and come upwind towards them.
The heart-shaped spoor of the buffalo, rather like that of domestic cattle, is easy to follow, if you have the stamina.
We should be well downwind of the buffalo now. I think they're they're making from what I can understand from the Bushmen, they're making for a perennial pool of water. And if we creep upwind now, after about 3/4 of a mile, we should be able to see them.
How do they know that those buffalo didn't move through, say, last night?
Because there are no other tracks overlaying them. You can see the sand trickling into the spoor a little. Yeah, no, it's quite fresh.
A gorgeous bush fight calls from a thorn tree. Nearby, a sycamore fig heralds the approach of water.
We've been walking for about 7 or 8 miles now. Already Robert and I are beginning to feel the effects of the sun, which is rapidly rising on the eastern horizon. And we're dragging our footsteps lightly, but there's a pause in the march. The bushmen are now squatting on their heels some yards ahead of us, chattering excitedly between them. And through the acacia trees, I can see a glint of water, rather muddy water in a pan, no more than 100 yards ahead of us. No sign of buffalo, although I've kept my eyes skinned, glancing fearfully over my shoulder. I haven't seen any sign of buffalo, but they're obviously there from the way the bushmen are chattering, and already they're beginning to make their final preparations before the hunt proper begins. The quivers have been unslung from their shoulders, and each of the leading bushmen has taken an arrow from his quiver and fitted it to his bow. And I notice that they make very, very sure that that poison is kept away from them. The arrow is very carefully taken out of the quiver, and they carry it down by their sides, the bow hanging by their sides, to make absolutely certain that they don't spear themselves or spear anybody who happens to be in the immediate vicinity. Anyway, the hunt is obviously just about to begin. They're pointing rapidly in various directions, obviously trying to maneuver themselves in this gusty blowing wind that changes direction. It's been blowing steadily from southwest, and now it seems to push round, veered a bit to more due south, and they're obviously trying to work out the best route for those buffalo, and already one is moving off left. And the other two are watching him go as he creeps silently through the undergrowth. Not even a crackle of a twig. I noticed myself just now that as we walked, Robert and I, we sounded like elephants going through the bush, but these chaps are silent. They don't make a sound whatsoever. Anyway, the one bushman has now disappeared completely from sight, and we're obviously waiting for something to happen. Robert, what is that chap doing? Do you think he's trying to get a better sight of the buffalo?
They've sent this one chap on to get a view of the buffalo and to see where the nearest point of the forest is to the nearest buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll come back and report, and then we'll creep on.
Because they might run into difficulty. I mean, we've been lucky so far. We've been keeping to acacia coverage. But once out in that open pan, isn't it going to be difficult to get close to them? I mean, these arrows have a range of, what, 100 yards, but they're only effective from about 25 yards. That means that they've got to use all their skills to get close up enough to the buffalo to make that strike.
Yes, well, when they leave the forest of acacia, they'll go down on their bellies and creep literally like a snake through the grass to get as near as they possibly can to the buffalo. I should think 25 yards. 20 yards, the nearer they can get to the buffalo, the more sure they are of putting the arrow where they want it, in soft parts, where there's more blood and it'll work through the body much more quickly than if it was through the thicker part of the hide and the shoulder.
Or the muscles.
Yes, right. Yeah, they'll probably try and place the arrow in the belly. Just in front of the hind leg.
Why do they choose the most difficult game of all, buffalo? Wouldn't it be easier, for instance, to go for sesame and impala?
Oh, it would be, undoubtedly. But a buffalo will feed the whole village for at least a week, which is something to be thought of. Here's the chap coming back now. Apparently there's a group of about 3 buffalo just standing about 40 yards from what he says, or short distance from the edge of the forest, grazing near the pool.
We'll make our approach from the forest side.
Oh, yes. Oh, rather, yes. And Minnow's going into the open at all.
The approach is made at a tangent to the buffalo. Now, the characteristics of the herd will be noted. Whether the buffalo are on the alert or at the graze. Whether they have eaten or are likely to move off? Will the thorn trees provide sufficient cover? Will the wind veer at an awkward moment? Only when all questions have been answered is the direct approach made.
There we are, Gordon.
Yes, Butler.
And there's the pan.
There's more than 60 there, I should imagine. Gosh.
Oh, yes, I should say there's definitely more than 60. There's about, near 100, I should think. And the three that the bushman just mentioned when he came back just now, here they are. Well, that's, there's a bull and two cows. And, they can't be much further off than, 40 yards. But I expect the bushman may try and get that cow there, just grazing behind the bull.
Yes.
Yes, there's one in the bushman moving off now. Well, I think we won't get too near him, because if we do, we might spoil a shot.
I've got a very good view of the pan in front of me. Immediately in the foreground is a small group of buffalo, some 12 or 14, I think they're about 60 yards ahead of me. That's on this side of the pool itself. You can hardly call it a pool, it's more like a muddy tract of water, probably about 10 yards to 15 yards in diameter, and the bulk of the buffalo are standing, ranged in groups, some drinking at the water, some quietly grazing on the other side of the pan. But, as Robert mentioned, there are three, a bull and two cows, slightly to the right of me, and already the leading bushman has got himself into position. I've never seen anything quite so exciting as the way he moved through this tall elephant grass, which admittedly gives him a degree of cover, silently worming his way over his stomach, elbows pushing silently through the grass, and must have gotten to position in no more than a minute and a half. And you must remember that he was carrying a quiver, his bow and arrow, and he didn't make a sound, or not a sound that I could hear. And certainly, watching through the binoculars, the buffalo didn't seem to react in any way. There was a moment when the 12 here in the foreground did raise their head, look towards the forest, and then satisfied themselves that there was nothing to worry about, resumed their grazing. Well, he's now in position, his bow in his hand, no more than 20 yards from the group of three, who are completely oblivious to his presence. They've got their backs to him, and the wind is blowing from them to us. And as I say, the bushman is in position. He's got his bow there. He's got his arrow out. He's straightening the flight feathers with his fingers. And now he's notching the V of the arrow into the bowstring, and he's giving it a couple of vigorous tests, casting his eyes at the buffalo every now and again. The other bushman sitting quietly, waiting for his strike. He glances down at the arrow tip, at the poison, red rust, lines of red rust on the arrowhead itself. He looks up again, and he's rising now to his haunches, his left foot put forward, acting as a prop, his right heel underneath his buttock for balance, his elbow tucked into his side as he draws the bowstring back 6 inches, 8 inches, 10 inches. The bowstave is now under extreme tension as the arrowhead moves back, now rests in line with the bowstave, his eyes traveling down the flight of the arrow itself. And now he waits, waiting for the wind to drop, presumably. And the bowstring twangs with a jerk, and the arrow's on its way. It struck home. I can't quite see.
One gun clean.
Even as Robert talks, the buffalo stampede. On the other side of the pan, the herd moves in a bewildered motion, their heads raised, sniffing the wind, trying to gauge the source of the danger. The wounded one, somewhere amongst them, trailing a poisoned arrow. Can he be tracked?
Oh, I think so, yes. These people can track like nobody's business. I mean, right through, they can track one single animal in a herd of 1,000. And they're taking a note of the spoor that the buffalo is making. And they can recognize that spoor right in the middle of a herd. And no matter how far they go.
How long will the poison take to work, do you think?
It depends on the constitution of the individual animal struck, and, of course, the strength of the poison. A maximum of up to 24 hours, I suppose. And, well, if we have a bit of luck. It's what, about 10 o'clock?
Perhaps we'll be lucky. We will find him dead before sundown.
Mm-hmm. Buffalo, of course, has a high resistance, and it does depend on the virulence, I suppose, of the poison itself.
Yes. How fresh it is.
The stamina of the buffalo proved to be as strong as Robert had anticipated. 5 hours later, with the sun burning relentlessly from a coppery sky, the hunters were still on the move. But their perseverance was to be rewarded.
Well, I think the buffalo is churning off here. This is why they're getting rather excited, I think. See, this is a spoor here.
Can I just have
a wounded buffalo? Yes, of course, here it is. They were churned off the left into these thicker mapanis here.
It's obviously slowing down, do you think?
Oh, yes. It's not kicking up in the front of the spoor.
Yeah, so am I right in saying that the main herd probably went over there to the left, and this one is trying to seek shelter perhaps in some of this thick mapani scrub?
Thicker, yes, more than likely.
Would it be dangerous?
Any wounded buffalo is dangerous. Oh, we'll go very carefully, but they've got such finny good eyes. Even in thick bush, they'd be able to spot a buffalo some yards before you got on top of it.
Yes. You can actually almost tell from the spoor. I've just been looking at it now. A certain scuff there. It might be my imagination, but it looks as if it's sort of dragging its weight along, looking pretty tired.
Well, it's quite some time since it's been wounded, and the poison is bound to be taking some effect.
Mm.
So it's feeling tired now, I think. I think they're going off now, so let's follow them.
Two long hours passed as they plunged into the Mapani forest, with the tsetse flies biting continuously into the flesh. The warning coughs of baboon bring the bushmen to a halt. Anxiously, they listen to the sound. There is something not quite right. Cautiously, they spread out, eyes scanning the Mapani forest. Their instincts tell them that the wounded buffalo is near at hand.
A touch on my arm, a silent touch, and a pointed finger from one of the bushmen indicates a direction slightly north of me. It's very difficult to tell directions because we're so surrounded by Mapani forest at the moment that I've quite lost my bearings. But anyway, all eyes are concentrated on a point no more than 50 yards ahead of us, bushman pointing frantically. And there, beneath the shade of a Mapani tree, hunched on its side, is the buffalo. After all this time, I believed that we'd never come up on it, but there it is, lying there, its flanks slightly heaving in the sun, flies buzzing round. It isn't dead. It's lifted its head to look back over its shoulder, and then back goes the head. It must be really on its last gasp.
Don't be too confident, Gordon. They're still dangerous, can be very dangerous in their last gasp, and they'll fight to the end.
Anyway, the bushmen seem to be circling round it rather tentatively, giving the credence to Robert's statement. One chap's gone off to the left, another chap to the right, and a third bushman is just ahead of us, moving very cautiously up to the buffalo. In other words, they're trying to circle round it, and I suppose the first man who gets to it, Robert, will stab it with a spear.
Yes, well, that long one, that very long spear he's got. He'll try and plunge it in his heart.
The poison certainly seems to have done its work. The buffalo is lying on its right side, kicking slightly with its back legs, trying, I think, to raise itself from the ground, but I think paralysis has set in. That is one of the effects of this poison, isn't it? Hemolysis, a sort of breaking down of the blood vessels or the blood corpuscles, and general paralysis.
I'm no doctor, but it certainly seems to weaken them to such an extent that they just can't get up.
Nothing is known of this poison, I should say. It is a concoction of their own, and it's very difficult to establish the symptoms, whether it attacks the nervous system or the bloodstream. I'm not absolutely certain. But one thing is for certain, that the cow is on its last legs. And any moment now...
There, I think he's just starting now. Look, he's just picking up his spear.
And the
yes,
bushman...
he's going to plunge it into the heart of the animal if he can.
Into the heart of the animal, yes. He's now inching his way forward. The bushman on the right and the other one have all stopped, frozen really in the act. They're watching him very carefully. In fact, we're all watching him as he moves in, and even the old cow lying there on her side is watching him intently. All eyes focused on this bushman now as he moves in, his spear held relaxed and light over his shoulder in a striking position, slightly back from his shoulder, actually. It's held at a slight arc so that he has maximum momentum at the moment of striking that cow. Now he's paused, standing no more than 2 yards from the buffalo. The spear is still raised over his shoulder. He strikes. There's a flash of the spear as it's driven home and the last convulsive movements of the buffalo.
I'm afraid that's the end.
Join us again next week for another story of the African bushveld. It might be fact, it might be fiction, in General Motors on Safari. Brought to you by General Motors South African, manufacturers of Cadillac, Buick, Oldsmobile, Pontiac, Chevrolet, Beaumont, Vauxhall, Opel, Holden, Bedford, and GMC Motor Vehicles.